Continuing with the chapter entitled The Unconditioned and Non-Locality. But before we go to the first of the sutta readings in this, I thought that I would follow up from some of the discussion in the previous readings and read the passages from Lungpo Cha that relate to the quality of the real mind and also non-abiding, referring to that as we get to that in this chapter as well. So this is the collected teachings of Venerable Ajahn Chah, and this section is from a dialogue called What is Contemplation? This was a group of Western monks led by Ajahn Jagaro, as he was then. He was the abbot of Wat Namachan just before Lumpo Pasanno took over, and he went to visit Lumpo Cha when he was staying for a short period of time in the village monastery where he'd been a dekwat, a kind of a child of the monastery as a lad, and had been a novice and been a bhikkhu there. And the village had donated that as a branch of Wat Papong, the main monastery. And Lumpo Cha was staying there with a few Western monks, Ajahn Tikinyano, Ajahn Goesako, Samanera Devisaro, and Pakao Sativ, who became Ajahn Kemanando. And then the group went over from Wat Nanacha. It's only about 5 or 6 miles away, 6 or 7 kilometers.
Well, it's about 7 kilometers from Wat Papong to Wat Nanacha, and it's sort of on the other side again from Bat Kol.
But not far away. So it was a group of Western monks from Wat Nanacha went over to see Lumpo Cha, and I believe it's mostly Ajahn Jagaro asking the questions. So we start in the middle of the dialogue.
Ajahn Titignano has a similar name.
It could, yes, it could easily be Ajahn Titignano. Yeah. I think he was senior to Ajahn Jagaro as well, wasn't he?
No, he is, Ajahn Titignano was, he'd be one year junior to Ajahn Jagaro.
Oh.
He was 1 year senior to me.
So we're starting in the middle. So this is the question. Is true contemplating the same as thinking? Lumpo Cha replies, we use thinking as a tool, but the knowing that arises because of its use is above and beyond the process of thinking. It leads to our not being fooled by our thinking anymore. You recognize that all thinking is merely the movement of the mind, and also that knowing is not born and doesn't die. What do you think all this movement called mind comes out of? What we talk about as the mind, or the activity, is just the conventional mind. It's not the real mind at all. What is real just is, capital I, capital S. It's not arising and it's not passing away. Trying to understand these things just by talking about them, though, won't work. We need to really consider impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and impersonality, anicca, dukkha, anatta. That is, we need to use thinking to contemplate the nature of conventional reality. What comes out of this work is wisdom. And if it's real wisdom, everything's completed. Finished. We recognize emptiness. Even though they may still be thinking, it's empty. You're not affected by it. Question. How can we arrive at this stage of the real mind? Lumpo responds, you work with the mind you already have, of course. See that all that arises is uncertain, that there is nothing stable or substantial. See it clearly, and see that there is really nowhere to take a hold of anything. It's all empty. When you see the things that arise in the mind for what they are, you won't have to work with thinking anymore. You'll have no doubt whatsoever in these matters. To talk about the real mind, quote-unquote, and so on, may have a relative use in helping us to understand. We invent names for the sake of study, but actually, nature just is how it is. For example, sitting here downstairs on the stone floor, the floor is the base. It's not moving or going anywhere. Upstairs, above us, is what has arisen out of this. Upstairs is like everything that we see in our minds, form, feeling, memory, thinking. Really, they don't exist in the way that we presume that they do. They're merely the conventional mind. As soon as they arise, they pass away again. They don't really exist in themselves. There's a story in the scriptures about Venerable Sariputta examining a bhikkhu before allowing him to go off wandering on the Duttangavata. He asked him how he would reply if he was questioned, what happens to the Buddha after he dies? The bhikkhu replied, when form, feeling, perception, thinking and consciousness arise, they pass away. Venerable Sariputta passed him on that. Practice is not just a matter of talking about arising and passing away, though. You must see it for yourself. When you are sitting, simply see what is actually happening. Don't follow anything. Contemplation doesn't mean being caught up in thinking. Contemplative thinking of one on the way is not the same as the thinking of the world. Unless you understand properly what is meant by contemplation, the more you think, the more confused you will become. The reason we make such a point of cultivation of mindfulness is because we need to see clearly what is going on. We must understand the processes of our hearts. When such mindfulness and understanding are present, then everything is taken care of. Why do you think one who knows the way never acts out of anger or delusion? The causes for these things to arise are simply not there. Where would they come from? Mindfulness has got everything covered. Question: is this mind you're talking about called the original mind, quote unquote?
What do you mean?
It seems as if you're saying there's something else outside of the conventional body-mind, the five khandhas. Is there something else? What do you call it? There isn't anything, and we don't call it anything. That's all there is to it. Be finished with all of it. Even the knowing doesn't belong to anybody. So be finished with that too. Consciousness is not an individual, not a being, not a self, not an other. So, finish with that. Finish with everything. There's nothing worth wanting. It's all just a load of trouble. When you see this clearly, like this, then everything is finished. Could we not call it the original mind? You can call it that if you insist. Call it whatever you like, for the sake of conventional reality. You must understand this point properly. This is very important. If we didn't make use of conventional reality, we wouldn't have any words or concepts with which to consider actual reality, the Dhamma. This is very important to understand. Question: what degree of tranquility are you talking about at this stage, and what quality of mindfulness is needed? Lumpur responds, you don't need to go thinking like that. If you didn't have the right amount of tranquility, you wouldn't be able to deal with these questions at all. You need enough stability and concentration to know what's going on, enough for clarity and understanding to arise. Asking questions like this shows that you're still doubting. You need enough tranquility of mind to no longer get caught in doubting what you're doing. If you'd done the practice, you would understand these things. The more you carry on with this sort of questioning, the more confusing you make it. It's all right to talk if the talking helps contemplation, but it won't show you the way things actually are. This Dhamma is not understood because someone else tells you about it. You must see it for yourself. Pachatang. If you have the quality of understanding that we've been talking about, then we say that your duty to do anything is over, which means that you don't do anything. If there's still something to do, then it's your duty to do it. Simply keep putting everything down and know that this is what you're doing. You don't always need to be checking up on yourself, worrying about things like, how much samadhi? It will always be the right amount. Whatever arises in your practice, let it go. Know it as all uncertain, impermanent. Remember that. It's all uncertain. Be finished with all of it. This is the way that will take you to the source, to your original mind. End of the chapter. Along the way, the phrase that Lumpur used was something along the lines of, if there's anything left, then you should throw it to the dogs. But I think the translator didn't think that would carry quite the same sort of tone as be done with all of it. I understand that was the original languaging. Also, when Lumpur Cha uses the word contemplation, I imagine that's pijarana, which also means investigation, exploring. So any questions, comments, thoughts? Anything to add to that, Lumpur?
It's always great to see just the way Lumpur Cha keeps just cutting through. And generally how patient he was with his Western disciples.
Exasperating Western disciples. Ajahn Kachana, yeah.
If people want to study that in detail, Ajahn Tanisaro has done another translation of it, which is probably more literal. I forget exactly where, but I think there's a note that may have even rearranged some of the sections of the dialogue in an attempt to make it clearer. And I think Ajahn Jeff listened to the tapes again and did a straight translation from there. It would be one of the talks in his book, In the Shape of a Circle.
I have some kind of idea that for good or right contemplation, we needed some amount of samadhi so that it won't proliferate big thinking. Is that correct?
That's correct. But it's enough to keep a balance so that you can both be clear and reflective and mindful, so that mindfulness and steadiness and reflectiveness are working together. And then to try to measure exactly how much of each I should have or need to have or must have or might not have, you know, ends up in a tangle. So it's just sort of, how do I get that sense of clarity and ease and steadiness? How do I keep it? So you have to work with that balance.
What they call that access concentration, first jhana, the qualities of first jhana include vitaka and vichara, sustained and applied thought. Most of the forest ajahns, as I understand it, they speak about that kind of level of concentration as being the most fertile ground for developing insight. That more absorbed than that, then it becomes a little harder to apply that reflective capacity. And less than that, then there's more of a tendency towards distraction. So it's what they call the littoral zone, not littoral, littoral, like where the sea meets the shore, where you get the warm tide pools, so where the sea meets the land. That's a kind of fertile ground for beings to evolve. That's the sort of littoral zone in terms of Dhamma practice. And like Lumpur Pasano was saying, it's going to vary from one person to another. Also, different times, different situations. We're not always the same person all the time. We vary individually within ourselves also. So that's something to be mindful of. If there's a thought, I just need this amount of focus, my mind is pretty steady, pretty focused, therefore this should be appropriate to explore this particular theme or this particular experience. But then mindfulness tells us, well, within 3 seconds, I'm off on another planet, or I'm revisiting the past or planning the future. Okay, the evidence is clear. That's not enough steadiness, that's not enough focus. So we're using the felt experience of the present to guide us rather than coming from a theoretically this is the right degree or this should be appropriate. It's like a living process, living situation. Carry on, yeah.
I don't know if in how I read my experiences, it feels like it's happening naturally. Or I believe when I call contemplation, when I think it happens naturally. In the way that it has a different texture.
Yeah, so that's a lot of what Lumpuchara is referring to there, is you don't have to be sort of measuring things or judging yourself or kind of that is sort of overdoing that kind of scrutinizing and measuring, but using your own, literally your own common sense, your own felt sense of, I thought my mind was busy, but actually everything's gone really very quiet and very still, very clear. Oh, okay, this is good. I thought I was quite focused, but whoa, I'm really stressing here. So that you're using that attunement to the living situation to guide you. And Erica, Jonathan.
I remember a few sessions ago, actually many more sessions, one of you mentioned another passage by Ajahn Chah, or perhaps this one, which was "What is wise reflection?" And this was named "What is contemplation?" Are they the same, or are they two different passages you're referring to?
I think it was the same one I was referring to. That whole chapter in that book is called "What is contemplation?" Yes.
Can I ask a question? It might be on the wrong track, but are there two different sorts? There's kind of the mindfulness of the mind, when you're noticing what your mind states are, or what your mind is doing and thinking, and then noticing that and working with that. And then you're talking about contemplating as a subject on its own, impermanence or not self. And it just seems to me they're two different things, and therefore two different approaches. Are there? Because I feel like I can manage the mindfulness of mind bit and the workings out of that, but sitting with a contemplation I find quite, you know, just waft off, because it doesn't have relevance to something I've noticed. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Contemplation of mind states, jhitanupassana, like knowing the angry mind is angry, or the concentrated mind is concentrated, the scattered mind is scattered, and so on. It'd be interesting to hear what Lumbar Pasano has to say. The contemplation and wise reflection, contemplation, investigation is looking at, say, the angry feelings or the agitated feelings or the quiet feelings. Oh, this is really interesting. Earlier today I was really busy. Now the mind is calm. It's not wanting to be anywhere else. Look at that. Where does this come from? That exploring what is present. But it doesn't have to be like a fixed theme, like, or today I will contemplate birth and death, or today I will look at my...
I'm sorry for interrupting. Is what you're saying is work with the direct experience, and yeah, not necessarily, because I do think about impermanence and can read about it, but it can only be, I'm putting two sides, but it can only work from the direct experience, or it has more impact.
Well, I'd say that, and kind of what Lumbar Pasano is saying here, is that taking what's risen naturally and then applying that investigative attitude towards that. Where does this come from? I was very peaceful this morning, and then I had that one two-minute conversation with somebody over the sink, and I've been buzzing all afternoon. Look at that. Where does that come from? Why did that comment have such a strong impact? I'm unsettled. The mind is feeling agitated now. Where does that come from? They're not disconnected. Contemplation doesn't have to be just sort of a theoretical subject. It's usually most helpful when it's something that is very live in our world, or something that makes us excited or afraid or irritated or just wants to get away, you know, that it can be picked up and explored. Would you have anything else to say on that?
Yes. I mean, there's several sort of angles or perspectives or things to pick up or tease out of that. There's a problem with the English language when you say contemplation, because if you say that in English, then you're already thinking. Because that's what's associated with, in the English language, with contemplation. I've got to think about something. Which in Buddhist practice, it doesn't preclude thought, but your best contemplation is quite thoughtless and much more. Like in the Pali, Yoni So Manasikara is, I mean, sometimes translated as, you know, wise reflection, considered attention, and it's a way of attending and using attention so that one's paying attention to the process of things and paying attention to experience. And part of that might be just its content. And part of it might be the actual characteristics, which would then be impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, non-self. So they're not two separate things, but they're two different modes of attending. Sometimes these are hard to talk about because it's just a way of applying the mind.
I said it a few times, but one of the ways of understanding that process of wise reflection or investigation, or Dhamma Vijaya is another parallel term, investigation of reality, is you're applying the ability of the mind to recognize patterns, which is not necessarily a verbal conceptual thing at all. It can be in terms of a vision, a memory, a feeling, how things fit together. It doesn't have to be in the realm of conceptual ideas and thoughts, words at all, which is where we tend to get very lost, is in the story making and conceptualization and get into a real tangle. So that using that capacity to recognize how things fit together, even when you use a term like causal relationships, you go, oh my goodness, cause and effect, that sounds technical, but how things work in nature, how things fit together, the processes of nature and the material elements, also the sense world, how it functions, how it fits together. So you're drawing upon that capacity to recognize and to get a feeling for how things relate to each other, and a feeling for the orderliness or the relatedness of things to each other. And part of that might be that things are in a state of disorder. You're like, whoa, this is a real mess. But that's part of that process. And like Lumbar was saying, it's not conceptual, and often our quote-unquote best contemplation is non-conceptual, non-verbal. Yes?
This is from quite some time ago, back in my yoga days, and I don't know if this is the right term, But I came across a text that spoke of samyama, if that's the right term. Basically, the way I understood it was just taking whatever object it is that you're contemplating and holding it, literally holding it in awareness. And it's that light of awareness that somehow unpacks whatever it is you're contemplating. And you can even leave it in the back and just let it sort of sit there. And it slowly unpacks itself over time and you see the different facets of it. But it's a way of holding whatever it is you're contemplating loosely, gently, and letting it reveal itself. And it's through the light of awareness that that happens. And I found that very helpful at the time.
Yes, that's a good way of expressing it. Okay, so to continue with our chapter, the last part of this narrative was the quote from Ajahn Mahabua: if there is a point or a center of the knower anywhere, that is the essence of a level of being. That's Lokdar Mahabua in Straight from the Heart. Secondly, we can take up the Buddha's own words on the nature of Nibbana, or Asankata Dhamma, the unconditioned reality. So these next two passages are very well-known quotations from the Udana, the Buddha's inspired utterances. These are both from chapter 8 of the Udana. There is that sphere, that ayatana, where there is no earth, no water, no fire, nor wind. No sphere of infinity of space, of infinity of consciousness, of nothingness, or even of neither perception nor non-perception. There is neither this world nor the other world, neither moon nor sun. This sphere I call neither a coming nor a going nor a staying still, neither a dying nor a reappearance. It has no basis, no evolution, and no support. This, just this, is the end of dukkha. And that bears a resemblance to a passage we were reading a few days ago, which is also from the Udana, chapter 1 of the Udana. Where water, earth, fire, and wind have no footing, there the stars do not shine, the sun is not visible, the moon does not appear, darkness is not found. And when a sage, a worthy one through wisdom, has known this for themselves, then from form and name, from pleasure and pain, they are freed. The next passage is Sutta number 3 in chapter 8 of the Udana, also in Itiwuttaka, Sutta 43. There is the unborn, uncreated, unconditioned, and unformed. If there were not, there would be no escape discerned from that which is born, created, conditioned, and formed. But since there is this unborn, uncreated, unconditioned, and unformed, escape is therefore discerned from that which is born, created, conditioned, and formed. So this is one of Lumpo Sumedho's favorite passages. When he and I overlapped in 2010, he was about to go off to Thailand after that Vassa, and I was just arriving to take up the role of abbot here. He made the suggestion, request, that this be included in the chanting. We do the Pali and the English together. It's called the Nibbana Sutta, Ajatang, Abhutang, Akatang, Asankatang, and we recite that fairly often. This was such an essential teaching, such an important principle. Lumpur Sumedho, he makes very few requests of that nature, but he said, please can we include this in the chanting book? So that was, on his request, we brought that in, the Pali and the English translation together. So that's already familiar to many of us who live here, that particular passage. It's significant that when the Buddha makes such statements as these, he uses a different Pali verb, to be, quote-unquote, than the usual one. The vast majority of the uses of the verb to be employ the Pali hoti, H-O-T-I, hoti. This is the ordinary type of being, implying existence in time and space. I am happy. She is a fine horse. The house is small. The days are long. In these passages just quoted, when the Buddha makes his rare but emphatic metaphysical statements, he uses the verb ati. So when there is that ayatana, that is in that sentence, is ati, ati bhikkhave ajatang abhutang akatang asankatang, A-T-T-H-I, ati. It still means to be, but some Buddhist scholars, notably Peter Harvey, insist that there's a different order of being implied, that it points to a reality which transcends the customary bounds of time, space, duality, and individuality. And that feels very, very significant. It's talking about a quality of being which has that transcendent and what you can call in English metaphysical, beyond the physical, beyond the conditioned qualities. It's not used that often, but whenever the Buddha makes this kind of emphatic declaration and is talking about things from an ultimate perspective, then that's the places where the verb ati would be used. Any questions? Yes.
The quotes from Lompa Mahabhuva talking about the point and the level of being, essence of the level of being. I read that section from that book. Couldn't understand the analogy of the point itself. I can understand because in nature, a point doesn't exist, but the phrase, the essence of a level of being, I can see what he wants to say, but can you explain if you...
Possibly. So the way it seems to be to me is that when the mind has that sense of this is being experienced here, the mind is here, life is known here, like I was talking about that feeling of locatedness, just that much grasping, that subtle kind of grasping, that's like the seed of birth in some level of being. So when it uses the phrase, that's the essence of a level of being, you could also say essence of birth in a level of being. Just that subtle quality of, like I was describing that experience in the rainy winter at Amayagiri. I'm not making any claims, but it was the reflections on anicca, dukkha, anatta. I was like, there's no sense of self here. There seems to be just a clear quality of knowing, and none of the usual areas of grasping are happening. But then noticing that kind of tensing in the system, that I feel is exactly the kind of subtle grasping that even though there might be no sense of I or me or mine, in a way it's the ninth and tenth fetters, udaccha. Again, we talked about that in the previous readings, that udaccha, which means restlessness, it's not fidgeting on your cushion because your knees are aching. It's the mind creating time and location, that there's another place over there. There's a possibility off in the future that is more real, more true, more good than this. So the restlessness is, ooh, what's that over there? Even at an extremely subtle level. Or that there's here, so then what's that over there? There's a there because there's a here. And that's creating, even though it's a very subtle kind of attachment, it's still creating time and location. So asmimana is the eighth fetter, the eighth of the Sanyojanas. Udaccha is the ninth. To me, I wouldn't say it's the only way of regarding it, but that ninth fetter is, even if subtle feelings of self have been let go of, there's still the mind is creating time and locatedness, and that can be invisible. But the insight of Lungta Mahabua is that any kind of here-ness that the mind is creating and holding on to, that's the essence of birth. That's what leads to the whole avijja paccaya sankhara and so on. And when that quality of knowing doesn't have a center, is not located, the mind is not creating that locatedness, then there is not that seed of birth or the mind gravitating to a place of birth, a level of being something. So that's how I would read it. Any?
Yeah, no, just because just those seeds of being are enough. Once you got a seed, you got the whole package.
Since we chanted so much the Nibbana Sutta, I note that the translation in the island uses either is discerned or can be discerned, and that's panyaya. The chanting, the English translation in the chanting book uses possible, which is less nuanced. It's actually helpful that the word in there is, you know, wisdom / discernment, just so people can recognize that. You know, it can be realized with wisdom, is what the sutta is saying, which is, again, a little bit more detailed than possible.
I think it was one of those poetic license things.
Rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, possible was more poetically suitable than discerned. I mean, that's how things get put into scriptures. Like, it sounds better. One of my pet theories with Lumpur Cha's conundrum of saying, if you can't go forward, if you can't go backwards, you can't stand still, where do you go? That he used to put to people as just as a kind of conversation starter. I never heard him explain it in that way, or never heard of him referring to this sutta, but it echoes.
Never heard him explain anything.
Yeah, this is true. But my feeling is it echoes that this I call neither a coming nor a going nor a staying still, and that has a resonance of Lumpu Cha saying, if you can't go forward, you can't go back, you can't stand still. And then Lumpu Cha's last message to Lumpu Sumato has a similar reference. So to continue, the next passage is also from the Udana, chapter 8. One who is dependent has wavering. One who is independent has no wavering. There being no wavering, there is calm. There being calm, there is no desire or inclination. There being no desire or inclination, there is no coming or going. There being no coming or going, there is no passing away or arising. There being no passing away or arising, there is neither a here nor a there, nor a between the two. This, just this, is the end of dukkha. And that seemed very similar to the teaching to Bahia, which is also very often quoted. In the seen there is only the seen, in the heard there is only the heard, in the sensed there is only the sensed, in the cognized there is only the cognized. This Bahia is how you should train yourself. When Bahia there is for you, in the seen only the seen, in the heard only the heard, in the sensed only the sensed, in the cognized only the cognized, then Bahia there is no you in connection with that. When Bahia there is no you in connection with that, there is no you there. When Bahia there is no you there, then Bahia you are neither here nor there nor in between the two. So not in the world of this or in the world of that, in the world of subject or the world of object, or somewhere in between the subject and object, nor between the two. That's also in the Udana, chapter 1. So then the next passage is from Bhikkhu Nyanananda's wonderful little book called The Magic of the Mind, which is his commentary on the Kalakarama Sutta. Bhikkhu Nyanananda is this very eminent and wise, experienced Sri Lankan monk who also wrote that book, Concept and Reality. And there's a whole collection of 37 Dhamma talks on Nibbana called Nibbana, the Mind Stilled, which is also his work. So, the concepts of coming and going are relative to the standpoint already taken in the process of identification. A relationship having been thus established between one's present identity and a possible future state, there follows the corollary death and birth, with its note of finality. With it, relative distinctions of a here, a there, and a midway between also set in. The entire process, whether it be understood in the context of the epicycle of samsara, traceable to every moment of living experience, or in the context of the larger cycle of samsara rolling in time and space, is a perpetual alternation between a thisness and an otherwiseness. Ittabhavanya attabhavang is the Pali for that, very long Pali word. Now, the such-like one who sees the danger in resorting to supports, which only give way underneath, grasps at nothing and clings to nothing. He has given up all standpoints, and in so doing has discovered a basis for firmness which never betrays. His is an unshakable deliverance of the mind, akuppa ceto vimuti, since he is free from attachment, anurodha, and repugnance, virodha, in the face of the worldly vicissitudes of gain and loss, honor and dishonor, praise and blame, happiness and unhappiness. The Buddha's declaration in the Kalakarama Sutta, thus, monks, the Tathagata, being such-like in regard to all phenomena seen, heard, sensed and cognized, is such. That is an allusion to this uninfluenced mind of the emancipated one. So his English is quite dense, so it's the kind of passage you think, well, wait a minute, I need to read that again. So it does take a bit of revisiting and getting the mind around those concepts, but I feel it's very helpful in talking about this area of the mind in relationship to being someplace, as he puts it, between a thisness and otherwiseness and such like. The next passage in the book is a long quote from Nagarjuna, which is a literal translation by Stephen Batchelor, but speaking of things being a bit impenetrable in English, this makes Bhikkhu Nyanananda seem positively Enid Blyton.
It's colloquial.
Quite colloquial, yes. So I thought I would skip Nagarjuna, with all due respect. Stephen Batchelor did a much more simple and readable poetic translation, which is more of a rendering. But what we had here was his literal translation, because we couldn't get permission from the publishers to reprint the poetic one, which we would have liked to have used because it's more understandable. I think it's called Verses from the Center, something like that. But Stephen said, well, you can use the literal one. You can have my permission for that. Since time is tight, and this will be the last of these readings by myself, I'll hand it over to Lumpur Pasanga tomorrow. I thought to skip Nagarjuna, with all due respect, and go on to Milinda Panha, the questions of King Milinda, which are much more understandable. Some similar areas of Dhamma were examined a few centuries before Acharya Nagarjuna and were recorded in the questions of King Milinda. It is significant in the following exchange between the elder, that's the Reverend Nagasena, Bhikkhu Nagasena, who was dialoguing with King Milinda. It's significant in the following exchange between the elder, Nagasena, and the king, how the element of morality, sila, and its role in the realization of Nibbana are brought firmly into prominence. And these are all quite antiquated translations by E.W. Burlingame, but I feel these are very helpful points. And the questions of King Milinda are not so often quoted or studied these days, but there's a lot of very helpful material in there. So firstly, Nibbana is neither past nor future nor present. It is neither produced nor not produced, nor to be produced. Yet it exists and may be realized. And this next section is called Nibbana is not a place. Reverend Nagasena, is this region in the east or in the south or in the west or in the north or above or below or across, this region where Nibbana is located? Great King, the region does not exist either in the east or the south or the west or the north or above or below or across where Nibbana is located. Yeah. If Reverend Nagasena, there's no place where Nibbana is located, then there's no Nibbana. And as for those who have realized Nibbana, then their realization is also vain. Let me tell you why I think it's so. Reverend Nagasena, just as on earth a field is a place of origin of crops, a flower is the place of origin of odors, a bush is the place of origin of flowers, a tree the place of origin of fruits, a mine is the place of origin of jewels, insomuch that whoever desires anything has but to go to the proper place and get it. Precisely so, Nagasena. If Nibbana really exists, it also follows that a place of origin of this Nibbana must be postulated. But since, Reverend Nagasena, there is no place of origin of Nibbana, therefore I say, there is no Nibbana. And as for those who have realized Nibbana, their realization also is vain. Great King, this is Reverend Nagasena replying. There is no place where Nibbana is located. Nevertheless, this Nibbana really exists. And a person, by ordering his walk aright, by practicing wisely, by diligent mental effort, realizes Nibbana. Great King, just as there is such a thing as fire, but no place where it is located, the fact being that a man, by rubbing two sticks together, produces fire, so also, Great King, there is such a thing as Nibbana, but no place where it is located. The fact being that a person, a man, by practicing wisely, by diligent mental effort, realizes Nibbana. Reverend Nagasena, let it be granted that there is no place where Nibbana is located, but is there a place where a man must stand in order to practice wisely and realize Nibbana? Yes, Great King, there is a place where a man must stand in order to practice wisely and realize Nibbana. But what, Reverend Sir, is the place where a man must stand in order to practice wisely and realize Nibbana? Morality, Great King, is the place! Exclamation mark. Abiding steadfast in morality, putting forth diligent mental effort, whether in the land of the Scythians or the land of the Greeks, whether in China or in Tartary, whether in Alexandria or in Nikumba, whether in Kasi or Kosala, whether in Kashmir or Gandhara, whether on a mountaintop or in the highest heaven, no matter where a man may stand, by practicing wisely, he realizes Nibbana. Good, Reverend Nagasena. You've made it plain what Nibbana is. You've made it plain what the realization of Nibbana is. You have well described the power of morality. You have made it plain how a man practices wisely. You have uplifted the banner of truth. You have set the eye of truth in its socket. You have demonstrated that right effort on the part of those who put forth diligent effort is not barren. It is just as you say, most excellent of excellent teachers. I agree absolutely. So it's a little bit Victorian in its expression. But that's when Burlingame was writing. So to underscore the quality of placelessness, the non-locality of Dhamma, here we have Ajahn Chah's final message to Ajahn Sumedho, which was sent by letter, a rare, if not unique, occurrence in the summer of 1981. Shortly after this letter was received at Chidhurst Forest Monastery in England, Ajahn Chah suffered the stroke that left him paralyzed and mute for the last 10 years of his life. I was there when this letter arrived at Chidhurst, and it was in Ajahn Sajjito's handwriting. And it started off by saying, "Dear Ajahn Sumedho, you're not going to believe this, but Lumpur asked me to take his dictation this morning." Sajjito, write this down. It was written in the handwriting of the then Ajahn Sajjito, and this is what it said. "Whenever you have feelings of love or hate for anything whatsoever, these will be your aids and partners in building paramita. The Buddha Dharma is not to be found in moving forwards, nor in moving backwards, nor in standing still. This, Sumedho, is your place of non-abiding." This was by no means the first time that Ajahn Chah had used this expression on neither moving forwards, backwards, nor standing still, for example, in Food for the Heart and in the collected teachings. But it's perhaps significant that these were the words he chose to write as final instructions to one of his closest and most influential disciples. This centrality of the principle that he's pointing to, that the conundrum can only be solved through non-identification with self, time, and location, is also alluded to by the opening sutta of the Samyutta Nikaya. So this is chapter 1, sutta 1 in the Samyutta. A devata asked the Buddha, "How, dear sir, did you cross the flood?" The ogha, "By not halting, friend, and by not straining, I crossed the flood." "But how is it, dear sir, that by not halting and by not straining you crossed the flood?" "When I came to a standstill, friend, then I sank. But when I struggled, then I got swept away. It is in this way, friend, that by not halting and not straining, I crossed the flood." In my reading of that conundrum that Lumpur Cha would ask, the Buddha Dharma is not to be found in moving forwards, nor in moving backwards, nor in standing still. Lumpur would kind of put that as a conversation starter, or just ask it as a question to people when they came to visit. And any way that the question is answered, based upon me being a person existing in time and space, he would just say, "No, that's not it, that's not it, that's not it." And that you can't dig a hole, you can't go sideways, can't climb a tree, can't go up in a balloon. People would be confounded, like, "Oh, what's the answer then? How is it resolved?" But the only way it's resolved is by non-identification with the body, the personality, with time, with location, with identity. And so that's what he would call the place of non-abiding. So I'll just read the last page of this chapter, just to close things off. "This finding of the subtle middle way, capital M, capital W, which transcends the two extremes rather than being just halfway between them, is a theme that is repeated throughout the Pali Canon. It's addressed particularly in the teaching to Bahia, as well as numerous other places. Perhaps a simple analogy for the finding of this mysterious middle is to be found once again in the three-dimensional magic eye pictures. At first glance, such pictures seem to be a blur of print, perhaps with no distinct forms discernible in them at all. The extreme of coming to a standstill or holding back would be to turn away and ignore the picture." Like, "I can't stand these things, they're really irritating. Pah, can't be bothered." Frequent relationship to those magic eye pictures. "The extreme of struggling or overreaching would be to stare at the page intently, rigorously following the instructions to hold it at the right distance, focus beyond the surface, but so eager to find the hidden image that the eyes cross and uncross, the vision blurs until eventually one gets a headache and gives up. It's only when there is the interest, the correct methodology, and a relaxed attention to the process that we find the palm trees and dinosaurs, the swooping eagle, emerging from the confused blur. And moreover, formed in a distinct three-dimensional realm that no amount of force or trickery or blind obedience to a formula can reveal." Again, all analogies are partial, and not every aspect of the middle way can be aligned with the magic eye picture. That's my caveat. That kind of pushing too much or not bothering at all, that doesn't work. But it's in that mysterious middle. There's a whole different dimension here. Like a tightrope walker balances by not pushing too hard or not being too still, but moving at just the right speed. Another analogy that might be useful when investigating these areas where habitual approaches and language no longer apply is in the nature of the subatomic realm. Scientists have found that conventional notions of space and time cease to have much relevance below the Planck scale, i.e. distances of less than 10 to the minus 35 of a meter. That's like very, very, very small, according to human scale. That's decimal point and then 35 zeros and then a one. Very, very small, according to the human scale. And Planck is not like in a wooden plank, it's Max Planck with a... Why are you measuring things by planks at that level? P-L-A-N-C-K, not the wooden plank. Such ultra-microscopic examinations of the world leave us, similarly, in a vastly different conceptual landscape, for they too describe an arena of the universe in which the conventional notions of left and right, back and forth, up and down, and even before and after lose their meaning. In sum, the mind cannot be said to be truly anywhere. Furthermore, material things, ultimately, cannot be said to be anywhere either. There is no there there, as Gertrude Stein famously put it. She was talking about Oakland when she used that phrase. There is no there there. The world of our perceptions is a realm of convenient fictions. There is nothing solid or separate to be found in either the domain of the subject or that of the object, whether it be an act of cognition, an emotion, the song of a bird, or this book that you hold in your hands, or the sounds of these words that you're hearing. However, even though all attributes of subject and object might be unlocated and thus ungraspable, with wisdom they can truly be known. Any final questions, comments, thoughts?
I remember in relation to Bouchard's Ivango forward comes in Spanish, the truth sustains itself. I can't remember where one of your books.
Well, there's certainly a few places in there.
The original, like following it, was saying vanish, the truth sustains itself. As an answer to the conundrum.
The truth sustains itself. Yeah, that could have been in one of my books. I quote that conundrum of Lompochard, but I couldn't possibly tell you where. No pun intended. You know, awareness is not. Awareness might apply, but I don't know where in this particular case. Let's see, page 339. It says, "Here we are." My goodness, 339. It's a sign, or not?
But somewhere.
When we see flowing water, it's just flowing along. When we see still water, it doesn't flow. But with our minds, it will really be like this, like flowing water that is still. In our Dhamma practice, we have samadhi, or tranquility, and wisdom mixed together. We have morality, meditation, and wisdom. Then, wherever we sit, the mind is still, and it flows, still flowing water. With meditative stability and wisdom, tranquility, and insight, it's like this. The Dhamma is like this. If you have reached the Dhamma, then at all times you will have this experience, being tranquil and having wisdom, flowing yet still. Still yet flowing. I'll leave it there. You can do your own researches. I'm not seeing the exact same quote, even though this is page 339, but maybe when that was published, this hadn't been published, so maybe this is was referring to an earlier edition. But anyway. Yes.
Ajahn, I was reflecting on the Bahiya Sutta, and I'm just wondering if this concept of bare attention, or just what is seeing is seeing, does that mean that it's before mental fabrications, and it includes feeling, like the Buddha with the yucca, unpleasant feeling? Or does it not include?
It does, yeah. It says, well, the third one, in the seen there is only the seen, in the heard there is only the heard, in the sensed there is only the sensed. So that's including smelling, tasting, and touching. And then the fourth one is cognized, which is referring to the mind sense.
So it would include feeling.
Yeah, so that's it just makes a shorthand of the smelling, tasting, and touching are all just put together as in the sensed is only the sensed.
Thank you.
Okay, so 7 o'clock has come, so let's wrap it up there.